Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. This episode marks the official kickoff of our fifth season. Now, we're a little late getting started this year. Those of you that don't live in Michigan, or Northern Michigan specifically, may not know of the terrible ice storm we suffered at the beginning of April. It was absolutely catastrophic and left hundreds of thousands of people without power for weeks, and some still didn't even have their power restored. Thousands of poles had to be replaced. It was literally one of the most amazing ice storms in the last 100 to 125 years up here. They say a quarter to an eighth inch of ice on any surface or trees, cars, houses, structures can be catastrophic. And we were looking at trees and even the twigs. The smallest twig on that tree could have easily have been coated in up to an inch and three quarters of ice. So it was absolutely spectacular to look at, but the destruction was still ongoing and really devastating to Northern Michigan. So here we'll kick off this season here just a little bit late, but we're very happy to be back. I've been fortunate enough to have spent the majority of my life here in Northern Michigan, one of my favorite places on earth. Childhood summers and winter vacations were spent on a private lake in Johannesburg, Michigan, just east of Gaylord, and my high school years in Traverse City before I, it was maybe 20 years after that before I figured out a way after high school to move back full time to Northern Michigan, someplace above the 45th parallel was my dream ever since I moved away after high school. In 2004, I was living in Lansing where I was born and my immediate family still resides. During my 20s, we had a family friend that lived on Round Lake in Lanesburg, 20 miles or so north of Lansing. And whenever we would visit him, he would tell us stories about the restaurant that sat on the edge of the lake, a few cottages down from the shore from his house. The restaurant at that time was called the Sweetwater Wharf, and as local lore goes, it was frequented during the 20s and 30s by Al Capone, when it was named the Club Roma or the Round Lake Casino. I always took the tales with a grain of salt for the fact that everyone I knew that had a place on the lake referred to their home as being the old Capone Cottage. If he was actually there, he could have only occupied a few cottages, but everybody kind of had that claim to fame. But the story of Capone's visits were quite prevalent and considered to be factual around the Lanesburg area, which again is just north of Lansing, Michigan. And then years later, in 2010, I had finally made the move permanently to Petoskey and opened up a jewelry store, Arlington Jewelers, which at that time was located in a building that was originally built as a speakeasy in 1911, which we had the public option up here, so we were actually dry years before the Volstead Act took effect. And soon after my business partner and I opened up the shop, I was told by somebody, I can't exactly remember whom it was, but we were always hearing crazy stories about our building, which has a lot of history going back. But we always had these people coming in telling us these recollections. And one person told me that somewhere down in the basement, among the bricked up passageways and tunnels from the Prohibition era, Capone had left his signature. Now, why he would have done so, I cannot answer, and I never myself was able to find the signature. However, most of the memories that I heard from locals during that 1 year we occupied the building have turned out to be absolutely factual, and actually the stories have surpassed any of the stories that I was initially told. I just keep finding amazing history about the building. But one slow day in the off-season, our first year open, we only occupied that building for 1 year before we were able to make the move down onto Lower Lake Street. But I began thinking of the stories I'd heard prior about Al Capone spending time in Michigan. So I took the opportunity to surf the web and see if I could find any documentation about the claims I had heard for years about Capone having been in Michigan. And I was able to find quite a bit of information that supported, at least in part, all the oral history and recollections I had heard from various sources over the year. The most interesting was a newspaper article that I found with a photo of Capone holding an American flag on a crowded street, along with a caption declaring him as the Grand Master of the Lanesburg 4th of July Parade. Now, this was years prior to Photoshop and the AI-generated fake news we've become so accustomed to and skeptical of recent years. This was an actual photograph of Capone in Lanesburg, Michigan. On April 18, 1926, by all accounts I've been able to reference, a local Chicago prosecutor named William Billy McSwiggin was gunned down by machine gun fire from a car known to be owned by Capone and driven by his henchmen in Chicago. At the time of the McSwiggin's assassination, Capone was still an up-and-comer on the Chicago mob scene, and Chicago officials were failing miserably to suppress the violence and corruption associated with the quote-end-quote beer wars at this time. The beer wars basically was a term used to refer to the fact that the local gangsters that were ruthless, ambitious, and brave enough to stake a claim were all fighting for control and the power that came from the huge sum of monies to be had selling illegal alcohol. Meanwhile, Capone, the main suspect in the assassination case, was eventually arrested and during questioning made the shocking accusation that prior to the shooting, he had been paying large sums of money to McSwiggin and his close associates in exchange for political protection of his nefarious operations. Ironically, prior to Capone's declaration of McSwiggin's alleged involvement in the corruption that surrounded the millions of dollars being made illegally from the sale of booze, McSwiggin was defined as a hanging prosecutor because of his tough stance on crime and his record of successfully prosecuting high-profile criminals. Immediately following McSwiggin's murder, which was unprecedented even during such a violent and turbulent time in American history, author Nate Henley writes that prior to his arrest for the supposed involvement in the gangland-style assassination, over 300 local law enforcement officers were searching for Capone. Now, this coincides chronologically with his purported time in the Lansing area. Now, for reference, prior to the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act that was passed in 1937 by all but two states, it was very difficult to extradite criminals from state to state under federal law. So Capone, during the initial storm and manhunt that followed the killing of a high-powered prosecutor, would only have had to cross the state line of Illinois to avoid being arrested. The prosecution of the murder of William McSwiggins was never resolved because of the fact that the primary witnesses all refused to testify. Traditional gangland-style warfare. This began the era of Capone's rule over the greater Chicago area. The rumors of Capone's Michigan connections are not limited to just southern Michigan by any means. Much like Hemingway, he seems to have been everywhere, including the Traverse City area. The most credible accounts, although, in my opinion, are of the time he supposedly spent in Escanaba, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula. While preparing for this episode, I went back to see if I could find not only the newspaper article I referenced earlier, but another article I had come across years earlier that had a copy of a deed to a house owned in Escanaba by Capone. I was unfortunately unsuccessful in finding either of the links that seem to have been absorbed into cyberspace over the years. Yet I do clearly remember that the article stated that during his lifetime, Capone only personally held the deed to two properties out of all the properties that he was the owner of. One was the house he died in Florida after being released from Alcatraz, and a house in Escanaba, Michigan. If you search Capone in Escanaba, you will be inundated by the seemingly endless references there are just of him frequenting the Hotel Ludington. Last November, my family and I traveled to Chicago for an end-of-season vacation and decided to make the trek home around Lake Michigan via Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula. After hours spent traversing the cornfields of Wisconsin, we decided to spend a few nights back in Michigan, where we found ourselves in a newly renovated hotel dating back to the 1920s, located just a few miles outside of Escanaba. The next day allowed me some time to spend, most of the afternoon actually, doing one of my favorite things, creeping around an old building, specifically the old House of Ludington Hotel. Skipping back just a bit, though, as we were turning to head east into Michigan, I was reminded of the fact that Dillinger, John Dillinger, another gangster of the same era as Capone, that also achieved celebrity status in the history books, traversed from Illinois to Wisconsin to lay low. The best documented and confirmed time he headed north out of the city of Chicago led to a shootout with authorities at Little Bohemia, a small bed and breakfast by today's definition. Little Bohemia is about equidistant from his primary hub in Chicago as Escanaba would have been to Capone. Now back to the House of Ludington. It's often said that sometimes it's better to offer an apology than to ask for permission, which was a situation I found myself in the morning I went to tour the Hotel Ludington or the House of Ludington. Upon my arrival, I found the front door locked, which was very disappointing, but not surprising because it was November and it was the Upper Peninsula, not exactly peak season. I did attempt to do the right thing, however, and called the number for assistance that was on the front door. Minutes went by, and then I was about to leave, and I saw a gentleman that had an apartment in the old hotel open the front door with his pass key, and I kindly asked him to hold the door. Now, to our listeners, I would say, please don't consider my inappropriate behavior as acceptable, and always, always get permission to investigate historic properties. Now, even though this is hypocritical advice, because I wandered the hallways and the back staircases of the hotel for at least half an hour before descending the main stairwell, only to find the manager looking at me from his position at the front desk. This podcast over the years has allowed me many amazing opportunities to receive special tours of so many locales over the year, and I was fortunate enough that this was one of those occasions. Tyler DuBord greeted me cordially and was generous enough to thankfully share with me and show me so much of the hotel's fascinating history as opposed to having me arrested for trespassing. And joining us today is Tyler DuBord. Welcome, Tyler.
Thank you, Chris, for having me. I appreciate that.
Well, I definitely appreciated the tour that day. And again, I grew up in Traverse City, where we used to sneak into the old state hospital and get in trouble periodically. I never got arrested, but I've just always been an urban explorer, and that building is just fantastic. When did you first come on board with the hotel?
Officially as the general manager of the House of Ludington, I came on when we opened 2 years ago, back in June of 23. I did work previously with the previous owners of the House of Ludington also in years ago. So I've always, born and raised in Escanaba, I've always known about the House of Ludington.
And growing up, obviously, you would have been exposed to all the stories about the hotel. Like even the main website, it just has a great run of the history of the building. It's called Who We Are, but the hotel, again, just so much history going back to, I think it was originally built in 1864. Is that correct?
Yeah, built in 1864. You think about that. That was a year before the Civil War even ended. And this building, this beautiful building, was built. Of course, when it was built, it wasn't built to its grandeur as it is now. There were later on expansions to the hotel. In about 1903, they added another addition or a wing to the House of Ludington. And at that point, when they added the wing in 1903, it actually got to about 100 hotel rooms by 1910. Can you believe 100 hotel rooms in this place? And you've been there, so you're like, how could you fit 100 hotel rooms in this hotel? But you got to remember, back then, these hotel rooms were very small.
That's exactly
they only
right.
had like a, you know, a bed and maybe a wash pan. There was no bathrooms in these hotel rooms at the time. So we think about that grandeur. It was a large, huge hotel back in its heyday.
Yeah, and we have a couple of hotels that are mothballed downtown Petoskey. People don't know. I tell people, when you're walking on a history tour or even just walking around, look up and look down. We have the National Hotel, which is getting ready to be renovated. But out of the 64 rooms in there, only two of them, four of them, two in the front, two in the back, actually even had windows. So that was luxurious. But yeah, very small, small bed, couple hooks for your clothing, and then a transom, not to let the fresh air in, but to try to let the carbon monoxide from the candles and the gas lamps out.
right.
Now, on the history on the site, it said it was built by originally by a lumber baron, Nelson Gaynor. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Nelson Gaynor was the proprietary or builder of this House of Ludington, and he was the one that built the building as a manor house. Later, it became like a boarding house, and then expanded beyond that when the next owners, the Christie family, took it over in the early 1900s. They developed it as a hotel saloon type of establishment, and then they ran it up to about 1939, 1940. And then we had our famous person that most people know in the community, or if you read history of the House of Ludington, Pat Hayes, took this over in 1940, and he was the owner, executive chef at that time. And he ran this establishment until 1969, where he passed away here at the House of Ludington. And he's well known in the community as Pat Hayes, because some of the people that used to work for him still are alive. And they love to come in and tell me some of the stories they experienced with him, that he brought the grandeur of the House of Ludington, made it a very famous, elegant place to eat and join into, with a very high-end steak facility. He was one of those people that, if you ever came into this building and you ordered a well-done steak, he would literally throw you out of the building and tell you never to come back.
Good for him. Good. I'm going to have steak tonight. It's going to be rare, medium rare, and I'm going to be furious if it's anything more than that.
Right, exactly.
Good for him for having standards. You can't cook a steak.
No, not at all.
One thing I came across, too, is that when it was originally built, it was kind of like located in the middle of what would be Ludington Street, but was moved to its present location in 1868. So when it was still in its smaller version, they were able to actually move it a little ways. Is that sounds correct?
That is correct. So they, at that time, were going to be putting in some of the piping or water lines underneath the Ludington Street. And at that point, the House of Ludington was actually in the center of their design of the roadway, and it actually had to be moved to the side where it is currently now.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of we stayed at Chamberlain's, which is it's changed names maybe, but maybe the name definitely changed owners since the last time we were there. But that was an old railroad hotel, and it was located obviously right next to the railroad in downtown Curtis. It took them a whole summer to move it to its current location, which was quite an endeavor. It's hilarious how they used to move houses back then, but you very rarely see a whole house being moved these days. But back then, they had the ingenuity and the. I guess you just didn't leave something like that in the middle of the road. You're gonna lose a beautiful hotel or a beautiful home or a boarding house. You would definitely move it to a new location and start up again. But it just cracks me up how much the ingenuity and the engineering based on that time they were quite innovative for what the tools and stuff would have been at that time.
Yeah, to lift the foundation and move it over and settle it and then keep it here since it's been. Moved over here since the late 1800s. So,
and then it says right around the time it became a 100-room hotel, they did what all the hotels in northern Michigan had started to do at that time. The fire was such a problem with hotels. Like we have hotels in Petoskey that burned three times. The Clifton Hotel burned to the ground three times. But one of the things they did when they renovated it between 1903 and 1910, when they finished up, it was one of the first hotels to have electric. Steam heat and baths. Baths was a big deal back in the day. And it says that the cost back then would have been about $2.
Yeah, if you look back then, you know, that was kind of still a little pricey back then, but you had the amenities that nowhere else had when you have that electricity and you've got that steam heat. And then to have the luxury of having a nice steam bath, I mean, who wouldn't want that in an elegant hotel? So, yeah, those are some of the amenities that were brought back in those days that brought in a lot of famous people, and it brought in a lot of people from all over to come visit the Grand Hotel, the House of Ludington.
Sure.
I mean, back in the heyday, I mean, there was people like the Prince of Bertel of Sweden stayed at the House of Ludington, to the Henry Ford family, to even Jimmy Hoffa stayed here when he traveled and did a presentation for a group of women here in the community.
Yeah, now we're getting back to the gangsters, and we know he was here. So, like, I was talking with a gentleman the other day, and and even you and I talked about it. Capone didn't sign in registry books, that wasn't his thing. But we know Jimmy Hoffa was there for a presentation.
Yeah, we know that for a fact because it was interesting that one of my clients was going through one of her mother's photo albums. And found this picture of Jimmy Hoffa with her and a group of ladies from the House of Ludington. And she was able to share that photo with me. So I thought that was pretty cool to confirm that Jimmy Hoffa was here presently at the House of Ludington. And we talk about, Al Capone. Yeah, Al Capone's not going to sign his real name at any registry.
No.
But the historians believe that, Al Capone made his way to the UP. He made his way to the House of Ludington during the Prohibition era. He stayed here in the third floor turret area. There's a fourth floor as well turret, and that was supposedly where his henchmen would sit up there and observe down below the activity in town just to make sure everything was going smooth while he was here. We talk about the prohibition side of it, of moving it or bootlegging alcohol or liquor throughout the community. Well, here at the House of Ludington, where old we are, there were tunnels that ran underneath this old hotel to be able to move what he wanted to move to bootleg, which is really cool. They're currently closed off, but back in the day, we do have those areas where you can see the remnants of where those tunnels would have been.
And it wasn't even just, it wasn't just tunnels you showed me. I mean, we went down into that first section. First of all, it's much more, I guess we have a couple buildings up here, and we just uncovered the Club Manitou, which was owned by the Purple Gang. And we've been doing tours out there, and we found that all the history and again, all the stories were even the real stories are even better than what we had heard. But the stairwell going down into the basement was very, comfortable. It wasn't like dingy and dirty. And then we got down into the basement and there was like a room to the left. And the glass windows were still there and looked like it had been kind of filled in with rocks or something. But, that room was down there for a reason. It was, a well-appointed room. It had glass windows. It wasn't like some Michigan basement. And again, we saw where that tunnel, that steam tunnel and the escape tunnel, possibly that Capone would have, utilized it as. But I was kind of amazed by those two rooms to the left right there, that, and one of the glasses, that some of the rocks that kind of pushed the glass out. But that room, right. that room was a very comfortable room. Capone's not going to be sitting down on some little dirt floor. And that's what we find over at the Club Manitou. It was very well appointed over there. So it just seemed like that basement was above and beyond what you'd expect for the aesthetics of a basement of a 100-and-some-year-old hotel. And even at that time, it still would have been 50, 60 years old and built in the late Victorian era. So those two rooms to the left kind of really impressed me.
Oh, big time. And as you recall, too, giving you that private tour, that you were able to see the false floor that we had.
Yep.
And then down below that false floor brought us down to the old liquor wine cellar down below. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it had that, you know, extra gap between the foundation and the liquor room, which allowed the movement behind that foundation to that hidden door that we saw where it still had the bricks sealing it up.
Yep.
So you know that that was an easy access, but hidden away from the public to be able to move what they wanted to move.
And that's what we find here in Petoskey, the building we occupied, which was at City Park Grill, and there's a lot of stories that have been made up about it, but I do the tours there and did a lot of research with the family, the Fochman family, and it's interesting that those buildings all operated right across the street from the courthouse. They had secret passageways that actually went to the courthouse. These communities didn't do without alcohol. And then, especially when you have a big hotel like that and you're on the water and you're so close to Canada, it was just an easy transition there. And then if you look back, like in places Capone was known to have hung out in Chicago, it was very rare that he hung out at any club that didn't have a secret escape route. Mm-hmm. Like he always had a plan B to get out of there. Almost any place where he would frequent where he wasn't completely protected. That's just a very, very common MO for him would be in a building like that with steam tunnels that could have facilitated his escape if necessary. Yeah, and as we go, you had some other famous guests too in the building. You said the Ford families, Thomas Edison, of course, you know, friends with Henry Ford, Johnny Cash and Escanaba. That sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, Johnny Cash was one of a frequent guests here as well. We've also had Patricia Neal, and just to keep going with that, one of the cool stories is if we're familiar with Will Chamberlain.
I love this story.
Who couldn't remember Will Chamberlain?
Yeah, you just told me this the other day, and it was not. And this part's not on the official history of the website, so go ahead.
So Will Chamberlain, when he was in the younger age, before he became in the NBA and famous basketball player he was, he started off with the Harlem Globetrotters. And he was with them, and Pat Hayes was the owner of the House of Ludington. And the Harlem Globetrotters were traveling through, and they just could not find a place to stay for this team. So they stopped here at the House of Ludington, and they asked if they were able to stay. And Pat Hayes welcomed them all in with open arms. And all of a sudden, they came in, and they put on this whole show right in our pub area. Put on this whole Harlem Globetrotter show, and one of the Harlem Globetrotters was Will Chamberlain.
Unreal.
And to this day, in our historical society has the picture of Pat Hayes standing next to Will Chamberlain at a very young age.
And I'm guessing
and
Pat Hayes
cool that,
was not
that
seven.
History just brings it to life, you know.
Yeah, and I'm guessing Pat Hayes was nowhere near 7 feet tall, right? So you can see Will's stature.
This is Tales of Northern Michigan's Past with Christopher Strubel. Join us next time as Chris continues his conversation with Tyler DeBoard, manager of the House of Ludington in Escanaba.